Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 56433, City of Reno versus Collip. Mr. Christensen for the appellant, Mr. Bowles for the respondent. Mr. Christensen.
Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court. Donald Christensen on behalf of the appellant, City of Reno. I'd like to reserve five minutes for rebuttal if I could, please.
Certainly.
There are three reasons why the district court judgment should be reversed in this case. The first is that the statute of limitations ran before any complaint naming the city was filed in this case. The original complaint that was filed in a timely manner with the statute of limitations improperly named only fictitious defendants, Does and Rose, as defendants. Rule 10 was not properly used, and the statute bars the complaint against the city. The second reason is that the only basis for liability alleged against the city in this case was on the basis of the theory of respondeat superior. That required some finding that some employee or agent of the city acted negligently and that negligence was attributed to the city. To the contrary, though, in this case, the court found that the only two individual police officers, employees of the city, who were alleged to have acted negligently were exonerated from liability because the district court entered judgment on their behalf. The third reason the judgment can be reversed is by reason of the application of certain governmental immunities, the discretionary function immunity, and the immunity granted to governmental entities for failure to discover any alleged defect in a vehicle.
Mr. Christensen, what was the final disposition of the first case that was filed in June 28, 2007?
That case was removed to federal court.
And what happened?
Ultimately, in 2009, it was dismissed by the federal court.
Okay.
But the city of Reno is the only defendant. The statute of limitations, if the court finds that, agrees with the city's argument, that could be the dispositive basis for reversing this, the district court's decision here. Let's talk about that first. The plaintiff was injured on March 20th, 2006, and the plaintiff filed suit against the city as the only defendant in June of 2007. That complaint alleged negligence and the use of excessive force. That case was removed to federal court because of constitutional allegations in that complaint. While that case was still pending, the plaintiff, unbeknownst to the city, filed this case in Second Judicial District Court on March 20th, 2008, the day before the statute would have run. In that case, even though he'd been litigating, the first case involved the same incident that had been removed to federal court. He'd been litigating that case with the city for some 8 months at that time as the sole defendant. He obviously knew the identity of the city, but still in the complaint that he filed in state court a day before the statute ran, was only against fictitious defendants, Rose and Doe defendants. Now, the city moved to dismiss that case, and that was on the basis of statute of limitations, and it was denied. Rule 10 is the rule that does allow a plaintiff to designate a defendant by a fictitious name if he doesn't know the true name of the defendant. There's simply no basis here for any argument that he didn't know the true name of the defendant, the city of Reno. You've been litigating the same incident in federal court with the city for the prior 8 months. Under Nuremberg, this court held that Rule 10 was never intended to reward indolence or lack of diligence by giving plaintiffs an automatic method of circumventing the statute of limitations. Given the fact that the plaintiff knew the identity of the city, there just simply is no basis for being able to use Rule 10 to file a fictitious defendant's complaint such as occurred here. So.
Mr. Christensen, again, subsequent to Nuremberg, a panel of this court in 2010 in the case of Sparks versus Alpha Tau Omega Fraternity, do you have any thoughts on the implications of that case?
I believe the Sparks case got into, Sparks or Costello, I can't remember which, but got into the what the due diligence is required as far as under Rule 10 and allowing an amendment back or relation back under Rule 15. But really, you never even get to that question, I don't think, in this case, because Rule 10 specifically says that, it's allowed a party whose name is not known may be designated by any name. And when the true name is discovered, the pleading may be amended. In that case, they didn't know the true name of some of the defendants. And the question, I think, if that's right, I think that's the Sparks case, is whether due diligence was actually engaged in by the plaintiff to properly name the correct defendants' names when they found out them. I mean, in this case, they already knew. They knew, they knew it was the city. They were litigating the city. It was the same incident, the exact same case, except it was in federal court and unbeknownst to the city until the city did not know about this amended complaint, or excuse me, the original complaint, naming only fictitious defendants, had been filed until after it was served with the amended complaint in May of 2008. The second reason why this case could be reversed and set back is that there simply was no basis for recovery against the city. I mean, the only allegation against the city in this case was that it was the political entity for the Reno Police Department. There was no allegation anywhere in the complaint that the city actually committed negligence in and of itself. The allegation was that the two individual police officers and then the manufacturer on a different claim were negligent, and that's what caused the injury to the plaintiff.
Who owned that transport vehicle?
The city. That's what it was, a transport prison. So the only basis that's potentially even allowable is respondeat superior, where you have to show that there was some act by some negligent act by some agents or employees of the city that caused the plaintiff's injuries.
But if somebody's arrested and they're put in a city vehicle, and the driver and the passenger, who both happen to be police officers, have no idea that there's a defect, why wouldn't the city be liable? If they knew that there was a defect in the seat belts or something else that causes someone who's being transported to be injured.
If those employees knew?
No, the employees don't know. In other words, they're just driving a car. It'd be like if I sent my law clerks out to do something and I knew about the defect, but they didn't. I knew about the defect. Why wouldn't I be liable or a city be liable under those circumstances?
That's not the circumstances we had here, because there was no showing that the city knew that there was some problem with the seatbelt. There's absolutely no evidence in any manner. The only evidence, testimony at trial by the police officers that were involved, was that they didn't know there was a problem. They'd never had a problem putting a seatbelt around anybody in the back. One of the individual officers, Officer Elgis, who was named, he had been involved in operating the vehicle for some 6 years. The only time he'd ever encountered any problem was when some prisoner hit his head on the top of the vehicle. There'd never been a problem before. There's no evidence to show that the city knew about any kind of a problem. The only basis alleged in the complaint was that the two police officers acted negligently, and those two police officers were exonerated by the district court. But just under Gunlock, this court's case back from 1962, the mere fact that there was an accident and someone was injured is not sufficient to impose liability. And when you really read the district court's findings of fact, conclusions of the law, it sort of looks like that's what he did. He says that the plaintiff went in uninjured and he came out injured, and he's holding the city liable as a result of that.
And the plaintiff's, the judgment in favor of the individual officers was not cross-appealed, correct?
Correct.
So that's a final judgment.
Correct. And there was no finding by the district court that there were a couple other officers there. There was no finding by the district court or allegation in the complaint that any of these other officers were negligent in any manner. So the city would submit that there was simply no basis for imposing judgment against the city, liability against the city. The final basis for reversal is that the two governmental immunities available to the city in this case. One is the immunity under 41.033. And it's not alleged, it's hard to tell somewhat from the district court, but to the extent that the court was trying to impose liability on the city for failing to discover that there was something wrong with this seatbelt or that it was not sufficient to go around the plaintiff, under that statute, the city is immune from liability for any failure to discover a deficiency in a motor vehicle. So we believe that the city cannot be held liable for if there was a problem with it not being big enough for failing to discover that in advance. There's no evidence they had any notice of that problem in advance, and we believe the city is entitled to immunity. And the final immunity available to the city is that of discretionary immunity. The case was based on the claim that the plaintiff was injured solely because the police officers made the decision to transport him without being seatbelted. Under the discretionary function immunity, there's two criteria. One, the decision must involve an element of choice or discretion, and it's undisputed here that this choice to transport the plaintiff was of that nature. And the second that this court has established is the decision must be of the discretionary function exception was designed to shield. In Martinez, this court held that the purpose of this immunity is to prevent courts from second-guessing executive branch decisions involving governmental policymaking or planning. We submit that this is the sort of decision that could fall within this discretionary function immunity, because, I mean, police across this state transport thousands of prisoners every year. In this particular circumstance, they were presented with a situation of what to do. They'd arrested an individual for a crime that's considered relatively serious, I believe, in this state, driving under the influence, and the seatbelt wouldn't fit around him. There was no other basis available to them to decide to transport him to jail. They had to decide how should they do so, and they tried to do it as safely as they could, but by reason of doing so, the plaintiff was injured. So
isn't there evidence that the ambulance company declined to do the transport?
They did. They had transported him first to the hospital because he had some knee abrasions before the prisoner transport vehicle took him. And in that case, he kicked out at one of the attendants in the ambulance service, and they refused to take him. The emergency room didn't want to keep him anymore, and there was no medical reason to do so. He couldn't fit in the back of the patrol car. The police officers had to decide and make a policy decision. How do we deal with a prisoner in these situations?
Was there any evidence how much Mr. Cullip weighed presented at the
trial? There was substantial evidence. It went back and forth. I mean, the police officers gave their estimate of being close to 300 pounds. I mean, that's disputed. It's a claim, I think, by the plaintiffs is somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 pounds.
How tall was he? What was the evidence?
I believe he's over approximately 6 feet or so, 6 feet, 6 foot one. But he's a very big individual, and it just wouldn't fit around him.
Describe you and me.
I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Can I just ask you one question about the discretionary immunity? Is that absolute or the type of immunity that has a cap? Because this judgment was under 50 or under 75. Is that absolute immunity?
It's absolute immunity. It's discretionary immunity. Thank you.
For the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, James Andre Bowles for Mr. Cullip, who didn't weigh 300 pounds. Now, the issues here are all factual, and the judge spent a lot of time hearing the evidence, and he heard a lot of evidence that later didn't pan out to be true. That's why this case went down the way it did. And I bring up the 50 pounds, the phantom 50 pounds, because that was a big issue in this case. And the other thing is the seatbelt wouldn't fit around him. That's not what was found, and that's not what the evidence supported. What the judge said was, and I paraphrase, is, well, I think something about whether it was the seatbelt or whether the officers didn't want to belt him in because he was obnoxious. And the evidence demonstrated that, and they admitted that they didn't want to have to reach across this guy and belt him in. Well, that's not a policy decision. That's not a immunity question there. That's, I don't want to do it because I'm lazy.
But then why would the judge... saying that the judge found that, why would he then dismiss against the two officers? It doesn't sound like the city's really involved in this, except under respondent superior, and they're the officers are the ones who felt this guy was obnoxious.
The evidence, and the record supports this, is when we got all done with this case, the lady officer, Hartshorn, she actually hadn't had any involvement with putting him in the wagon. We didn't know that until we got to trial. It didn't come out. It was my impression during discovery that she was somehow involved and that she was there, so she should have had some involvement or at least should have said something about it. But the fact of the matter is this guy was strapped in or not strapped in. He was placed in the wagon by Officer Crow, who was not named, but an agent of the city of Reno, giving rise to liability for the city. Short answer to your question, Your Honor, is the city was found liable because there was many agents that put together this scenario that gave rise to this injury. That is, starting with, and I'll argue, the manufacturer was an agent of the city of Reno. Built that, and it came out in on the record, that they built that wagon for the city of Reno pursuant to the city of Reno's specifications. Beyond that, the city of Reno put that wagon in use, supervised its use every day, hauling, as Mr. Christensen said, probably thousands and thousands of prisoners. Then you get to Sergeant K, who's got some involvement, supervised what happened here. Bottom line is, there were many agents of the city of Reno involved in setting this whole thing up. And when, and I don't necessarily agree with Judge Palaha when he let the two officers off the hook, but what Judge Palaha did say in his decision is that he didn't find them liable as individuals or in their individual capacity. So it's, that is not a clear-cut issue, but it, what is clear-cut is that the city, through its agents, was the controlling agent and gave rise to liability based on everything that all these people did up to this March day in 2006. The other thing that, besides the phantom 50 pounds, the other thing is that the judge found, let's say, little or no credibility in how the officers explained this incident. In other words, what he said, and it's mentioned and it's on page 6 in our brief, that what the judge said was he, in essence, he didn't believe the officers when they said that this guy rolled out of his seat onto the ground. He said that he believed that Mr. Collip had to be standing up, which was directly contradictory to how the officers explained this so-called accident. The other thing, and the court asked a question about the federal case, and what I would point out in the federal case is that was a Section 1983 case. That was a case where we filed against individual officers, and typically those cases end up only against the individual officers because in a Section 1983 there is no respondeat superior. So apples and oranges. Why would we know what the city's liability is when we filed the second case, and that's why we filed it as a John Doe or Doe and Roe Corporation case? It's because we didn't know at that point and wouldn't know until I think it was April 16th, a month after we filed it, nearly a month after we filed it, when we took depositions. We didn't know what the city's involvement was, if any. At that point, we didn't even know who was driving the wagon. We didn't know who put him in the wagon. We didn't know if there was a negligence case at that point, because we filed the first case, and I'll use an old police term, as something they call a screen test. That is where officers are involved in punishing an unruly prisoner. That's how this case started out. And the fact of the matter is, when we got into the case and were litigating it, we found out the only people who knew what happened were the two officers, because they were the only two people on the scene, and we were hoping that somebody from the medical responders could help us, but they didn't. The only two people on the scene who knew what happened were Elgis and Hartshorn. Our client, Mr. Collip, couldn't recall a thing. He said he remembered something about some voices, people talking, but he didn't know what happened to him. So that's how this case started out. It didn't start out as a negligence case. It started out as a Section 1983 excessive force case.
But prior to that, wasn't there a police report that you could have gotten that would have just laid this out for you as far as drafting a complaint? the police, didn't they make a police report on this?
They made a police report, and the police report was very self-serving. And there was never an accident report. We never saw a use of force report. And the only record said that they thought he stood up in the wagon and hit. I don't remember exactly, but it was very unclear what happened. That's why I believe it would be irresponsible to name the city of Reno in this case until we had some solid discovery, evidence that the city of Reno would have. Because if those officers are acting...
But wait a minute. You named the city of Reno as a defendant in the first suit that was filed asserting 1983 liability against the city.
That's a Monell.
What was the basis for the allegations against the city? You knew who it was, you knew it employed these officers, and you knew there was an incident. So
that was
what more did, I mean, if you had a basis to sue the city in that first complaint that was removed to federal court, I'm struggling to understand why you had no knowledge of the city when you sued in state court again on negligence theories and had an epiphany after you deposed the officers whose names are in the report. I'm struggling with this.
Two things happened, Your Honor. To start with, that was a Monell claim.
Understood.
So
this case against the city had to be stronger under Monell you to name them as a defendant on a 1983 claim. I mean, that's an extraordinary claim that you would name the city under Monell in the first place.
Well, to start with, Your Honor, the Monell claim is based on years of experience and a policy maintained by the city of Reno to not properly investigate and to overlook acts of violence by officers. It doesn't give rise to negligence, especially if the officers who were involved were acting outside their course and scope. If they're outside their course and scope, then there is no negligence on the part of the city of Reno. And we didn't know whether they were inside their course and scope until we'd done some discovery. And that's when we filed the amended complaint, because we found out two things. We found out who was involved, at least what their theory of what happened was, which gave rise to negligence. And the other thing we found out is we've got to go thoroughly inspect the offending vehicle, and we found out at that time, and only then did we find out that, and this is a very large issue that everybody, that the city kind of tries to step over. That's kind of a double entendre, because it's this box in the back of the wagon. It's in the compartment, but it's set up forward close to the front wall, the bulkhead. We didn't find out about that box, that steel box, upon which he busted his face until May 2nd. That's when we found out that not only a few days or 2 weeks before, we found out that they were apparently acting within their course and scope, but we also found out that the city provided them with a very dangerous instrumentality. That's why we didn't know what, if any, involvement the city had outside their policy, which doesn't give rise to negligence, outside their policy, which allows this sort of stuff to go on. We treated this case, and truth of the matter, it's always been our position that this was a 1983 case. The problem is it was not a case that we could ever prove without more witnesses, without some witnesses. And the officers gave very self-serving testimony. And the bottom line in this case is there's the case that the city claims was decided incorrectly by the judge, and then there's the case that was decided correctly by the judge, which was based mostly on the lack of credibility of these officers. These officers were entirely without credibility. They're arguing, they made up this, I have to go back to the Phantom 50 again, 50 pounds is an awful lot of weight, and it made these officers, it demonstrated that they were not credible. The court found that the one thing he could tell was that their account didn't happen that way, that this box and this steel box in the front of the compartment upon which he dashed his face was a dangerous condition that they knew of and did nothing to stop. And then on top of that, you've got the phantom seat belt that didn't reach around this guy. Well, it was very well established through medical records and the jail records that there's no way that Mr. Collip weighed anything near 300 pounds. He weighed 246 pounds when he got booked 6 weeks later because he didn't get booked the night of this incident.
How tall was he?
His testimony, it says in my brief 6 feet. There's somewhere it says that, but my recollection in his testimony was he's 5'11 and three quarters.
Okay.
Very close to 6 feet.
Around 6 feet.
Around 6 feet.
Mr. Bowles, let me ask you this. The original complaint was filed June 28, 2007. That was the one that went over to federal court. What discovery was done in that case? And didn't the federal court enter a scheduling order with deadlines on discovery and all?
We didn't do any serious, well, we did interrogatories, that sort of stuff. We didn't actually start taking depots until the first depot was taken April 16th. Well, they might have taken my client's depot before that. I take that back. We took the depot of the two officers in April of 2008 after we'd filed the second state claim or second state complaint. So the discovery.
So the depots were taken under the federal case then, like?
Yes. They were taken, my recollection is they were taken under the federal case. And typically what happens in these cases, I'm saying this is typically what happens, is there's a motion or two that gets filed right out of the box in the federal cases. And that may be why it took us months to get actually down to the nitty-gritty of discovery, other than things like interrogatories, requests for admission, that sort of thing.
And was the federal case dismissed with or without prejudice?
Without prejudice. That's my recollection. We dismissed it without prejudice.
Was it by stipulation or by court? The court joined it on its own?
No, I believe we reached an agreement with the court to dismiss that because we had this other case, and by then we realized we're not going to be able to put on a Section 1983 case, and we're certainly not going to be able to put on a Monell case with the lack of evidence that we had proving intentional acts.
Okay. Did you ever make a request to remand the case from federal court back to state court? Or when it was removed, did you just proceed accordingly?
That would have been a frivolous motion on my part because we had Section 1983 claims in there. We don't have a basis to bring it back unless they would agree to it. And obviously, since they took it away from state court.
Right.
So,
okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I suppose. Mr. Christensen, rebuttal. You have 3 minutes and 26 seconds.
If I could, the first thing is, the nature of the first case, as Justice Pickering already pointed out, I think there's pleadings in the record here on appeal that shows pleadings from the first case. It was filed only against the city of Reno. The original claims were for negligence and for excessive force. There were, in fact, so obviously the plaintiff knew who the employer of the police officers were. There were police reports on October 11, 2007, in the record this is shown, that on October 11, 2007, the plaintiff produced documents to the city which included the police report that identified the two individual officers as the transporting officers here. And a week later, the city produced a supplemental report by one of the individual police officers, which is all in the record in connection with the city's motion to dismiss, that shows further what occurred that day. So it's just, I'm not sure how further to respond to the claim that he didn't know the identity of the city. There was pending litigation. He knew it was his client was being transported, or the plaintiff knew he was being transported by City of Reno police officers in a City of Reno vehicle, and the City of Reno had been sued. There just simply is no explanation for not naming the city in the complaint that was subsequently filed to start this case until after the statute was run.
Do you want to comment on why you think this was sovereign immunity, discretionary as to what the officers did? I mean, did they have any discretion at all of not putting this person in the van and transporting him? They could have left him on the street.
They had to decide what should be done with this individual. He was very, very intoxicated. The other options were out. The REMSA wouldn't take him, the ambulance service in Reno. There was no reason to keep him at the hospital any further, and they didn't want him anymore because he had spit at least one of the nurses. They had to put a spit hood on him. They couldn't put him in the back of a regular patrol vehicle. They just couldn't get him into the rear of that car. They were out there with this heavily intoxicated individual, and they had to make this decision. What do we do under these circumstances? And right or wrong, they did what they did and attempted to transport him to jail. They drove 10 to 15 miles an hour for about three blocks. It was 33 seconds from when he was from their last stop to when they stopped the prisoner transport vehicle. And that during that 33 seconds is when the officers saw him fall over on his seat, which is why they stopped. And then when they finally got to the back to look at him, he had injured himself. To me, that falls within the discretionary immunity. The other assertions here, Mr. Bowles says the issues are factual. I don't see it like that. I'm talking about sufficiency of evidence. It's really not a factual issue that way. It's legal issues is what we're talking about. The actual judgment that was entered in favor of the defendants that was not objected to in any manner in the record is after hearing her testimony regarding this matter, this court hereby finds in favor of defendants Anthony Elgis and Amanda Hartshorn and against the plaintiff. That's at Joint Appendix 892. It does not distinguish in any manner. It just the claims were found that the case was resolved in favor of those individual defendants. The manufacturer being an agent of the city, I don't recall any evidence in the trial at all as to how that transport vehicle came to be ordered by the city. It was all the evidence just addressed that particular incident in which the plaintiff was injured. But as the district that you reversed the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Thank you, Mr. Bowles, for your argument and your briefs in this matter. This case will stand submitted.